So now we'll go into our meditation. So we're already in a relative state of resting the mind, and let's just focus in on that again in a very loose, relaxed way. And within that state of the mind being at rest, we will contemplate the four reminders, the four thoughts that turn our mind away from digging ourselves deeper into samsara and freeing ourselves through practice and study, contemplation and practice of the Dharma. So first, the precious human existence. Just taking a moment to appreciate that in this moment, in this lifetime so far, we have all the conditions that we need to attain awakening, to attain our full potential of wisdom and compassion. So we need to make use of it. Secondly, impermanence and death, that this opportunity can end at any time, so we can't waste it. We need to practice now. Third, karma, cause and effect, that basically it's our own actions that determine our future in this lifetime and in future lifetimes. If we engage in actions that are positive and helpful, we will reap happiness. If we engage in harmful actions, we will reap suffering in the future. If we engage in practice, we will reap liberation. And fourthly, the suffering of samsara, or what's wrong with samsara, because we've learned that there's no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence. Even our happiness is suffering in disguise. We need to use our life not to get a better, more pleasant samsara and situation, but to really free ourselves from it as best we can, to whatever degree we can, so that we can then help free others as well. So with our own motivation set, we now request the Lama's blessing. So if you have a relationship with a teacher, you can visualize them in a body of light above the crown of your head on a lotus and moon seat. Generally, we visualize not as the individual person, but as the primordial Buddha Dorje Chang. You could also visualize the Buddha there instead. or even someone from another spiritual tradition. Whoever you feel connected with in a way that empowers your practice. And with or without words, we request the blessing of the Lama to help us attain the state of full awakening. And just by asking, we receive that blessing and that empowerment. And we can then visualize the Lama or the Buddha descending from above the crown of our head into our heart center, where he or she comes to rest and remains there whether we're aware of it or not. So that awakening that we're seeking is always within us. So now we take a moment to stabilize our resting state. We can follow the breath for a few rounds or simply open up your awareness again and rest in open awareness. And now we'll go through the steps of cultivating ultimate bodhicitta, or wisdom, taken from the Great Path of Awakening, the 7 points of mind training. So first, we let go of the solidity of our environment, and especially of all our internal thoughts, judgments, emotions, and so forth, and look at all our experience in this moment as a dream, as if it were a dream. Just a moment of relaxing away from gripping so tightly onto what we perceive as our reality internally and externally. really thinking we could wake up from this. And then second, examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, which means to simply turn our attention inward, to look at the mind itself, at awareness itself, see what we find there. We could ask some questions. Does it have shape? Does it have color? Is it located in a particular place? Does it come and go? Whatever question we wish to ask. And just rest in it. Rest in the question. You probably won't get an answer. Just asking and resting and looking. And remaining within the state of rest, we let even the remedy release naturally, which means that whatever process of examination we engaged in, whatever conclusions we may or may not have come to, we just let go of that as well. Basically, stepping away from all conceptuality, which brings us to the final step, rest in the essence, the basis of everything, our Buddha nature, the nature of mind, the way things are. Whether we feel we recognize it or not, that's where we can rest now. When concepts re-arise, we just relax away from them, let them go, let them dissolve. So without losing touch with the state of resting in the essence, the basis of everything, we cultivate relative bodhicitta or compassion through the practice of taking and sending. The instruction is practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. So first, there's a lot of ways to go into taking and sending. Today we'll do the classic way of bringing to mind someone that we love, someone that we naturally feel compassion for, someone we know or someone we're aware of. And develop the fervent wish in our heart for them to be free of suffering. And then we imagine whatever suffering they have, we can breathe it in and take it away from them by just breathing it in through our nostrils, through all the pores in our body with each in-breath or every few in-breaths. Just breathing in their suffering and thereby freeing them from it. And sometimes it helps to add a visualization of breathing in the suffering as like a dark, smoky, heavy light. And then on each out-breath or every few out-breaths, we can breathe out to them in the form of white moonlight or multicolored rainbow light. We can breathe out to them whatever they need: happiness, healing, peace, awakening, food, shelter. So we just continue to alternate breathing in the suffering and breathing out what's needed. And this doesn't take all of our attention. So with the majority of our attention, we're still in touch with open awareness, resting in the essence. And now we'll extend this feeling of compassion, this wish for beings not to have suffering. We'll extend it gradually, step by step, to all sentient beings, starting with someone we don't know very well, someone we see, maybe a neighbor we don't know, maybe a person who works in a store, someone online, and add them, breathing in their suffering, whatever it may be. Letting it dissolve along with our in-breath. Breathing out to them whatever they need. Breathing out to them that they have everything they need, that they be happy, that they be safe, that they heal from whatever they need healing from. Continuing to breathe in their suffering, breathe out the antidote. And now, an optional step, you can just stay with what you have, or you can extend this compassion to someone that you consider an enemy, someone that causes you problems, someone you don't get along with. Breathing in their suffering, breathing out a real heartfelt wish for them to have happiness, healing, and peace. If that one is too hard, you can go back to the first one. And now expanding our intention and visualization to include all sentient beings, whatever kind of suffering they may have, not only humans, but beings in all six realms, animals, hungry ghosts, hell beings, God's realms. Breathing in everyone's suffering all at once, letting it dissolve along with our in-breath. Breathing out happiness, peace, and awakening. Staying in touch with open awareness. Now taking a moment to think that through this activity, through our practice, all beings, including ourselves, are now completely free from suffering, completely filled with peace and happiness, and completely awake. Taking a moment to rejoice in that. And now letting go of all visualization, all conceptuality, coming back to a state of resting and open awareness, with our thoughts coming and going freely, not grasping onto anything, but just resting in the flow of experience, in the state of spacious, open awareness. And now coming back at your own pace to study and contemplation mode. And I will turn over the class to Lama Junzang.
And I'll begin by reciting, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll begin by reciting the four dharmas of Gompopa. Daktang Semchen Tanche Lo Ji Su Jo War Sin Ji Lap Tu So Chu Lam Tu Jo War Sin Ji Lap Tu So Lam Ju Pa Sel War Sin Ji Lap Tu So Ju Pa Ye She Su Jo War Sin Ji Lap Tu So I pray for a blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for a blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And then from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke du luda nu jin ke ju bun da ta mi I ke nan da jo wa kun chi dra ke chi san par tam che ke du da ki chu ten to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans do. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now I ask that everyone engender the altruistic attitude of bodhicitta. And to do that, please think that you're going to, or we are all going to, give rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So we are in the text, Path to Buddhahood, which is providing by Rinko Tuko, who is providing teachings. It's not a straight commentary, but teachings on Gompopa's jewel ornament of liberation. And we're using this text, the ornament of precious liberation. So that's the new translation, the ornament of precious liberation. And in brief, the ornament of precious liberation is a lamrim, or a complete a text which covers the stages of the path from beginning to the end, from understanding why it is that it is possible to attain enlightenment, and then the stages needed to needs to practice, or the various conditions one needs to gather, and the methods of practice, and finally, having attained enlightenment, what the actual qualities and benefits are. And so we began already with the basis, which was, now this, again, the text is in, Gompopa provides what it's called in this Rinko Tuko book, page 5, he says, the six factors to achieve this goal. Gompopa explains the six factors are necessary. So the cause, and we've learned that the cause is that each and every being has within them Buddha nature, which is the same thing, is the same qualities and characteristics of a complete Buddha. It's just that these qualities are completely obscure to us by the various veils and obscurations. But in this text, through various types of proofs, it was determined that all beings without exception have within them the Buddha nature, the cause to attain enlightenment. The second of the factors was the basis, which was the precious human existence, the fact that not only that to be a human, we have the best conditions because we have the experience of suffering, but it's not all pervasive, so that we have leisure or the time to actually turn our minds to the Dharma. We also have the ability to practice not only, and a very main point also of not just being human, but that we have all of the eight, what were called the eight,
freedoms.
Freedoms, meaning the different the stages or states of mind or place that we've been born in, such that we are most importantly have access to the Dharma and have the ability to understand the Dharma. And the ability to practice. And so for those reasons, it becomes precious. So we should use that, the time now, because it's very hard to find this type of, this set of conditions again. And having found the basis, though, that is not enough. We also need the condition, which is where we are now, the spiritual friend. So I'm going to ask you to turn, if you have the text. I'm going to just reread some of where we were last week, just to help refresh us and bring us back to speed of where we left off. So I'm on page in Rinkotoku 23. So it says, the third factor, the condition to reach enlightenment, is meeting a genuine spiritual friend. This is a person who has the ability and willingness to guide us in the right direction and in whom we have the trust and confidence to follow. What chains us to samsara is our deep-rooted habit of always following either the wrong direction or erroneous schemes. To help us, protect us, and encourage us to completely abandon this habit and to guide us in the right direction, we need someone strong, a friend whom we can rely upon. And it says, without serious help, a drug addict or an alcoholic is not likely to overcome his or her addiction. In the same way, without an experienced guide whom we can totally trust, we will have a lot of difficulties getting out of the samsaric patterns to which we are deeply accustomed. So I'd like to just reread then from Tim Olmsted, again, on why it's important to have a friend, a spiritual friend. And he says, we can ask ourselves, how do we know what is possible and how to proceed along the path, other than through the guidance and example of those who have gone before? This is simply what we call lineage. Can we make up our own stories? Can we pull this path out of our head? We can no more do that than conjure up a map to drive to New York City if we haven't already been there before. It is a nature of confusion that we cannot make up a path by ourselves that wakes up. We need to be open to something else, to someone else. As an example, we cannot navigate the way through confusion by ourselves. You could say we do not know what we do not know. It's as if we wanted to become a tennis player, and in doing so, we hung out with other tennis players, we open ourselves to their guidance, we lean into them, we follow their example, and we gain encouragement and strength from them. The lineage is very much a training paradigm, you could say, that we lean into and we open up to the pros that went before. And now back to the Ringu text. Rinkotoku text, it says, this chapter is divided into five parts. The first outlines the three reasons it's necessary to have a spiritual friend. The second lists the four categories of a spiritual friend. The third describes the essential characteristics of the different types of spiritual friend. The fourth gives advice about how to enter into a relationship with a spiritual friend and specifies what questions to ask. The fifth describes the benefit that a spiritual friend brings. So I'll continue for a little while longer. It says, why do we need a spiritual friend? Gampopa justifies the need for a spiritual friend by making three points. The first, as we've understood before, is scriptural authority. So there are three types of logic used. The first is the scriptural authority, basically the Buddha's own words. And so he quoted them many times. He says, good disciples devoted to their teachers should be guided by wise and skillful mentors. Why? Because that is how their own qualities of skill and wisdom will emerge. And again, thus the great bodhisattva who wishes to awaken genuinely and totally to peerless, utterly pure and perfect enlightenment should from the very outset seek out, relate to, and serve good mentors. And now I'm skipping down to the next paragraph where it says, however, because now we're into the second type of argumentation, which is logically based. It says, however, if one doesn't have too much trust in the Buddha's words, another argument is given. The second point is logically based. If we sincerely desire to stop suffering, live correctly, and realize enlightenment, then there is no way to reach these goals without the help of an adequate spiritual guide. To find the right path, we must first find someone who has already treaded it. Without an appropriate guide, how can we find the path to enlightenment? And the third argument is based on justification by analogy. And in the text of Gampopa, he speaks of three types of analogies. He refers to the Dharma masters as being like guides, escorts, and ferrymen. And so I'm just going to read again back to Ringo Toku, the last paragraph in 24, where he gives his commentary on that. He says, the third argument is in fact an illustration of the usefulness of a spiritual guide. Gampopa gives us several examples. If, for example, we cross the desert without a guide, we will go around in circles lost in the immense expanse of sand. In the same way, without a skipper to cross the ocean, we will never reach the other side. We have as much need of a spiritual guide to cross the ocean of some suffering, of the ocean of samsara, and reach the shore of awakening. A spiritual path is not just an intellectual pursuit. It is about transforming our way of experiencing and reacting to the world. We need to learn how to do that the way a musician learns how to play an instrument. We need an experienced teacher who can show us how to do that and who can help us in our learning process. And then the third of the five, where again, he said that the chapter is divided into five parts. So the third of these is describing the essential characteristics of the different types of spiritual friend. And it says here, just briefly, I'll be just excerpting from this text. Again, Ringo Toku, page 25. The different categories of spiritual friends. Gampopa distinguishes four categories of spiritual friends. The first groups together spiritual friends who are ordinary human beings. The second, the bodhisattvas who have reached a high degree of spiritual development. The third, the emanations of the Buddhas in the Nirmanakaya form. And the fourth, emanations of the Buddhas in the Sambhogakaya form. Although the great bodhisattvas are ideal teachers, it's not easy for ordinary people like us to recognize a member of the latter three categories, much less make contact with them. The category of masters to whom ordinary people like us can have access is the first one, the masters who are not totally awakened, but who are well on the way. They are more or less like us, but already have a certain training, a certain level of serious spiritual practice. This type of spiritual friend is appropriate for the student of the first level. So we now are working with ordinary spiritual friends, meaning the beings that we actually have the capacity to perceive and to learn and train with. So now we can skip over the next section, which is the qualities of these ordinary spiritual friends. It was divided into eight, and then four, and then into two. And I would like just to bring up another way that it can be described, and this is coming from Minja Rinpoche, that there are four qualities that accompany an authentic teacher. One, authentic lineage. Two, history of study and practice. Three, compassionate and good-hearted. Four, being humble. So today, I'm going to pick up in the text. So in terms of page 27, when it's now talking about the fourth part being giving advice about how to enter into a relationship with their spiritual friend and specify what questions to ask. So this is page 27, the master-disciple relationship. And what I'd like to preface this by is to remind us of, or for those who weren't here last week, then to say it again, one of the points that His Holiness Karmapa brought up when he taught recently, I guess several months ago, it feels like it's recently, but relatively recently, when he was at the Riverside Church in New York City, and he taught on the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. And in the practice of the Bodhisattva, the 37 practices, verse 6 is about relying on the spiritual friend. And it was a very meaningful description, the way he spoke, because he said, he pointed out that in texts, often, or in all of the traditional texts, the spiritual friend is always described from the ideal point of view. And in reality, this is very problematic, because spiritual friends may not be flawless. There are two points he said. Is one, that even if a spiritual friend were in fact flawless, because we, being ordinary beings, project our own negativity, our own habitual patterns for projecting, you know, just negativity onto the beings around us based solely on what our internal mood is, having nothing necessarily to do with anything external, but just something arising in our mind. You know, it's like if you get up on the wrong side of the bed, everything seems, you know, bleak, whereas if you woke up and felt very rested, things wouldn't bother you in the same way, so that your underlying moods from your own side impact the kinds of thoughts, or inform the kinds of thoughts you have. So even if we were to find a flawless spiritual friend, through our own negative poisons, we could be projecting negativity onto the spiritual friend, and therefore we couldn't even begin to see something that was flawless, you know, in that way. We would be projecting flaws. But in general, spiritual friends or teachers, and especially the ones that are being described as the ones that we can relate to, as Rinko Toku was saying again, he said that those are more or less like us, but already have a certain training, a certain level of serious spiritual practice. This type of spiritual friend is appropriate for the student of the first level. So how His Holiness Karmapa said is that to determine whether a teacher is authentic is not whether they have all of the qualities described perfectly. So again, it is not as if they are ideal in that sense, but their authenticity is determined by the benefit it brings to each student personally. So one shouldn't be talking about spiritual friends in isolation as if this being is all good to all beings equally, but it's more use to think of them in interdependence with a particular disciple like oneself. And then when looking at oneself, you should be thinking, you should be relying upon spiritual friends who cause your negative qualities to decrease and good qualities to gradually increase, and cherish the spiritual friend who brings about these changes. So I bring this all up because we will be referring shortly to the Ornament of Precious Liberation, which does in fact, again, present it in the very ideal perspective. But I wanted to say that at first. So, and we'll come back to Rinko Toku also talks about this. But in any case, getting now into page 27, the master-disciple relationship, it says, once we have found a guide who possesses all or most of the qualities previously mentioned, there are three ways in which we should behave. So again, it's very important. Note he says, or most of the qualities. So really, it's about balance. When you look at the teacher that you feel resonates with you, and if you project or perceive what you see as faults, if in fact the benefit that you perceive is greater than the flaws, then that's okay. Then you can trust that being. And we were reading last time, and I don't remember where, it was in the Karmapa's text about it being very important that you don't select a spiritual friend based on whether you like a person or not. And this is what he was saying. He was saying in this text, traveling the path of compassion, it seems on page 61, it says, not choosing a spiritual friend too soon means that when we start searching, we consider whether a person has all or most of the qualities of a teaching. So again, he's mirroring what Ringu Toko just said when he says, we consider whether a person has all or most of the qualities of a teacher. This is the focus of our investigation, not whether we like the person or not. If we are preoccupied with our likes and dislikes and do not examine someone's qualifications as a spiritual friend, we will not know whether we are attracted to a good person or a bad person, or someone who has the necessary qualities or not. We could like someone who does not measure up, and without knowing it, we could be relating to an unqualified person. For that reason, we shouldn't be too hasty in choosing a spiritual friend. So again, another point here is that, it's saying, just like His Holiness Karmapa was saying, you look to your own experience and relationship, and is that spiritual friend, in fact, increasing your positive qualities and enabling your negative qualities to diminish? It's not a question of whether you like them or don't like them. And I said also again, my experience with my teacher, Lama Norla Rinpoche, back in my first retreat, when he said, my job is not to be your friend. My job is not to be your therapist. My job is to help you prepare for the moment of death. So now I'd like us to turn, if you have the text, Ornament of Precious Liberation, we're going to go to page 42. Oh, I'm wrong. That doesn't appear to be the right page. We're going to page 42, I'm sorry, where it says it's the second from the end paragraph. It says the fourth point is how to rely on the Dharma master skillfully. So again, this is going to present a very ideal, notion, and we will work with other texts as this comes up. And again, I'll be taking questions at the end, but I'd like to cover the material because some of it might answer some or speak to your thoughts. And then at the end, we can all enter in discussion about, what this is bringing up for us. So it says again, an ornament of precious liberation. It says, the fourth point is how to rely on the Dharma master skillfully. Once someone has connected with such Dharma masters, there are three ways of relying on them: by showing respect and rendering service, by cultivating the relevant reverence and devotion, and third, by personal Dharma practice and earnestness. The first of these has two parts. Showing respect is accomplished by prostrating to them, rising quickly when they enter, bowing to them, circumambulating them, speaking at the appropriate time with a loving mind, looking at them again and again with an insatiable mind, and so forth. Secondly, I'm going to skip over the quote and go to page 43, where it says, relying on Dharma masters by serving them. So again, this is the two parts of the one is showing respect, and now we're rendering service. So it says, relying on Dharma masters by serving them is accomplished by catering to their needs. This means providing them with food, clothing, bedding, seating, medicines when they are unwell, funds, and the like, in a way that accords with the Buddhist teaching. This is to be done without heed for one's own life or physical well-being. And I'd like to stop here because this is addressed later in Ringu Toku's text. Again, this very sort of ultimate way of done without heed for one's own life or physical well-being. This will be, Ringu Toku will have his take on this. So I'm going to then skip down. So that's the first way, is showing respect and serving the teacher. And then it says, the second way is to rely on them by cultivating reverence and devotion. Having established the concept that the teacher is a Buddha, whatever the teacher says is to be taken to be instruction, never to be transgressed, to be followed in constancy and with the cultivation of reverence, devotion, and joyous trust. And this, again, it just says it was exemplified by the way Master Scholar Naropa relied on his guru, as it said in the Mothers of Conquerors Sutras, earnestly cultivate reverence for Dharma masters, follow them, and have joyous trust. So again, Rinkel Togo will be addressing this. But before I get to that, I'd like to bring in, because it's now interesting, introducing the idea of thinking that the teacher is a Buddha. And I'd like to speak to this by introducing some commentary I have that was written by Mingyur Rinpoche in a teaching he gave on devotion and the Kagyu lineage. And this was in the context of a Guru Yoga teaching, but it helps to clarify, or it's one way of clarifying how we come to think of our teacher, any teacher that we have that resonates with us, how to think of them as equal, being equal to the Buddha. So it begins, and this is page 8, children. When we supplicate the Lama, whether we obtain the blessings of all the Buddhas and the Lama depends on our faith. If we do not have faith, even if our teachers were Dorje Chang, meaning the Dorje Chang, Vajradhara, and the Buddha Shakyamuni, and we were next to them all the time, without faith in them, no blessing would enter us. So again, so it says, for example, Buddha Shakyamuni had a monk called Gelong Lekpe Karma. He stayed with the Buddha for 25 years, but he did not generate devotion for the Buddha. Therefore, he did not receive blessings. If we perceive our Lama to have the lineage, even if he is like a normal person and he does not have very high realization, if out of our faith we perceive him to be a Buddha, then we will get all the Buddha's blessings completely. So generating faith for one's Lama is very important. What type of faith do we have to generate? We have to have faith that the Lama and the Buddha are inseparable, that they have the same qualities. There are two reasons for that. One is based on the relative truth, and one is connected with the ultimate truth. The one related to ultimate truth is that the Lama has Buddha nature, and that Buddha nature is Buddha. So again, this is coming back to what was discussed in the beginning of the introduction that Lama Chudrin taught, and then when I was going over the first chapter of the cause, which was the Buddha nature. The fact is that, if you remember, it taught that the nature of both samsara and nirvana is emptiness, that emptiness is Dharmakaya, the nature of Dharmakaya, ultimate reality, which is synonymous with Buddha nature. And since both Buddhas and sentient beings have the same nature, emptiness, Dharmakaya, then, which is synonymous with Buddha nature, then sentient beings have Buddha nature. So the point is that Buddha nature, the ultimate nature of reality, which is simply not, is our within all of us, but unrecognized because it's as this point obscure to us by misperception and misunderstanding. The point is all beings equally have the same nature. And the only difference between the Buddhas and sentient beings was that Buddhas recognized the nature and therefore did not suffer in relation to their notion of recognition of emptiness, but sentient beings not recognizing the emptiness, the nature of phenomena, suffer. So going back, and again, I'll take questions. I know this is dense, but I'd like to just finish reading this and then we can take questions regarding this if you have. So it says, the one related to ultimate truth is that the Lama has Buddha nature and that Buddha nature is Buddha. Therefore, the Lama and all of the Buddhas have identical nature. The Lama really is the Buddha. Not only is the Lama a Buddha, the student is also a Buddha. Why is that? It is because the student also possesses Buddha nature. If you understand that, it is called ultimate guru yoga. It is like the Lama's mind and your mind are meeting. When we say the Lama's mind and the student's mind are united and become mixed, it is not like you have to pick some substance in your right hand and some substance in the left hand, grind them and mix them up together. It does not mean that. The first thing to understand is that one's nature and the Lama's nature are the same. Understanding that, one understands also that all the Buddha's natures are identical. If you understand correctly one's own Lama, his mind, and your own are inseparably mixed, that is the reason relating to the ultimate truth. What is the reason connected with the relative truth? The Buddha said that generally all the Buddhas possess compassion and skillful means. For all the vast number of sentient beings, the Buddhas do what they can to help each individual being appropriately to that being's nature. We ourselves have negative karma and illusions. Because of our impure perceptions, we cannot perceive pure perceptions. Right now, this moment, Dorje Chang is present before us. We cannot see him. We cannot hear his teachings. This is due to our own negative karma and negative or impure perceptions and illusions. So what are we able to see? We can see somebody who is rather similar to us, somebody of flesh and blood who suffers, who appears to be like us because they have suffering and mental defilements. That type of person we can perceive. So the Buddhas, in their infinite wisdom, compassion, and skillful means, emanate beings who look like us, like His Holiness the Karmapa and Taisiji Rinpoche. In the world now, there are many beings like that. They look like us. They appear to be the same. They need to eat food. They become sick. They need to take medicine from time to time. And they also manifest death. And sometimes they make a few mistakes. They appear to be like that. They appear to be like us. And because of that, we are able to see them and relate to them, and we are able to listen to the teachings they give. But truly, their real nature is that of the Buddha, because they are the emanations of the Buddha. If a Lama has all the characteristics and possesses the true lineage, he or she is an emanation of Buddha. That is the reason relating to the dimension of relative truth. In brief, one needs to have faith and supplicate the Lama. The root of the blessing depends on our generating faith for the Lama, devotion. In Milarepa's life story, it tells you what he did and what kind of experiences he had, how he generated faith, etc. One day, one of Milarepa's students approached him and said, "You know, when you were with Marpa, he gave you all those difficult things to accomplish, and you did all those things, you practiced, and finally you became enlightened. Surely you are not a human being like us. We cannot hope to do this kind of thing. Maybe you are an emanation of Dorje Chang, or maybe another Buddha. Would you please tell us whose emanation you are?" Milarepa replied, "For you to think that I am an emanation of a Buddha is a very good thing. But as far as I am concerned, I do not know whose emanation I am, if I happen to be the rebirth of a hell being, because you perceive me as an emanation of a Buddha. That is very beneficial to you." We can see that everything depends on the generation of one's own faith and devotion. If you understand that the nature of the Lama is Buddha, but that the Lama's kindness is greater than that of the Buddha, then one will naturally give rise to faith and devotion for him or her. That is the explanation for showing us that the nature of the Lama and the Buddha is identical. Now, there is a little bit of discussion about how it is that the Lama's kindness is greater than that of the Buddha's. Even though Dorje Chang and Buddha Shakyamuni are very important and great beings, you are not able or fortunate enough to hear their teachings to obtain empowerments or scriptural authorities from them. You are not able to meet them even, but we can actually meet the Lama physically, hear his or her speech, and receive his or her teachings, empowerments, and instructions. If we were to meet the Dorje Chang Buddha in person and ask for teaching, if he was going to liberate us and lead us to enlightenment, what could he give us? He could give us the instructions on how to practice and liberate ourselves within one lifetime. Higher or better teachings than that, he would not be able to give us. He could not just pick us up and throw us into a pure land. This type of instruction one's own Lama can give, how to liberate oneself in one's lifetime and become enlightened. We are not able to perceive Dorje Chang, but we can perceive our own Lama. So who is more kind to us? Is it Dorje Chang or the Lama? It is the Lama. If you understand that point, faith and devotion will arise. So now I'd like to just return to, so that is, we're back on page 43. And so again, I hope that that has spoken to the point of view where it says the second way to rely on them is by cultivating reverence and devotion and how we might do that. And so we're just going to continue in this book for a little while longer where it says, besides this, so we're still in the second way, it says, besides this, wrong ways of thinking about the personal conduct of masters should be abandoned because their conduct is in fact their skillful technique at work. Instead, cultivate the noblest intention, devotion for it. This was exemplified in the biography of King Anala. I'm not sure if that's how to pronounce it. So I'd like to turn to the footnote. It says number six, the footnote number 60, page 300 in this text, where it then briefly says, the Bodhisattva Suddhana was sent to King Anala to learn compassion. But when he arrived, he saw what seemed to be the king judging and punishing evildoers mercilessly. Thus, he initially doubted the king's bodhisattva's qualities. However, he listened to his inner voice and went to the king, who then took him to wonderful paradises and explained that he could manifest visions of the worst punishments or the greatest rewards in order to instill confidence in moral discipline in his subjects. So in brief, this is a story that's elucidated in a much more fully at the back of this text, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, if anyone has this book. But the point is that this student was sent to the king, who was said to be a great master, and when he got there, he saw him putting beings under horrific torture and killing them when they did not act in accord with perfect or conduct. And so he was questioning the activity and was developing wrong view towards the teacher. But then when he went to the teacher was saying that in fact, he was actually manifesting. He himself was manifesting this activity of, and so all of these beings that were being tortured, etc., were purely projections of his mind, weren't actually in fact any of his country people. And so this was his way of providing very strong examples such that the people in his country would act in accord with proper conduct. And so that the point is that when the student first saw this activity, he had very wrong views and he didn't recognize that the teacher was in fact using skillful means to train.
Could I just interrupt you for a second and ask if other people are having any technical glitches or it's just me? Everybody can hear okay and see okay? Okay, great.
Okay. So now we're on to the third way to rely on a master, and it says is by Dharma practice and earnestness. There are three steps to Dharma practice in this respect. First, to study Dharma under the master's guidance, then to contemplate its significance, and finally to make it a reality in practice. And so now that's the end of this text, and we're going to finish now back in Rinko Toku's book on page 37. Okay.
I think that's page 27.
You are so correct. Thank you very much. So apparently there's no glitch with that one. Okay, thank you. Okay, so it says, so again, this is the master-disciple relationship. And so it says, first we should show him or her our respect and try to be useful to him or her, which we can do in three ways. First, to offer material commodities, hospitality, food offerings, and so on. The second is to offer respect and services. The third is to offer our practice. Of the three, the last is the most valuable. The best reward a master can get for his or her efforts is to inspire students to practice and thus the benefits thus brought to them. Second, to be able to practice correctly, a student must listen attentively to his or her teacher's instructions and never be afraid to ask questions. The most important thing is to eliminate doubts, to clarify whatever may seem obscure, so as to practice with a clear mind. We should not be satisfied with a vague understanding or with retaining only that which suits us. Instead, we should try to deepen our understanding of the teachings until no doubt or uncertainty is left. We shouldn't listen only to what we like or understand or are familiar with. This means we have to be constantly attentive, with a totally open mind. It is only with such an attitude that we will receive everything the teachings have to offer. The problem is that we all have preconceived ideas. As soon as we hear something that fits our own ideas, we think, now there's an interesting idea, that's very pleasant. When we hear something that goes contrary to our ideas, opinions, and beliefs, either we distort what we hear until it harmonizes with what we think and can nod, there, that's the way it should be understood. Or we reject it altogether, branding it as completely incomprehensible. This is not the correct approach for a student who sincerely wishes to learn. A serious student must open his or her mind completely and try to understand the teachings as they are and without distorting them. This is not to say that we should not use our intelligence, we should, but first we should listen and try to understand what is being said. So now this is an extremely important point for me, is that he keeps referring to the teachings. He does not say here, first we should try to listen and try to understand what the Lama is saying. He's saying what the teachings are saying. So it's extremely important to understand that the teacher is the vessel through which we gain access to the teachings. And that is where this is what is extremely important, that the spiritual friend is, as Lama Norla Rinpoche once said, preparing us for the moment of death through the teachings. And so how we are relating is not just directly to the teaching, but at this point, if we've taken a being to be our spiritual friend, we are now seeing them as the guide. We are seeing them as the means by which we are gaining access to the methods, to the practices, to the path. So it continues, it says, we should note that a fruitful practice is the best gift we can give our spiritual friend, because the more we practice, the better we practice, the more we attest to his teaching abilities. So again, it's not saying that the most important gift or best gift we can give is in service and in respect, that all being important, but the best we can do is to actually put into practice his teachings. And if we see that the teaching is then benefiting us, that our qualities are, again, positive qualities are increasing and our negative qualities are diminishing, that is not only showing that the practice is beneficial, but it is supporting his ability to be able to teach. The Tibetan tradition attaches great importance to what is called the transmission lineage, through which a particular teaching is passed on from master to disciple from one generation to the next. What we call the lineage holder is the person who trains the best students. A realized and very accomplished master is not necessarily the holder of the lineage. It is the best teacher who will be the lineage holder. So again, this is sort of a tangent, because this is not to say that your teacher therefore has to be a lineage holder in order to be the best teacher. It's just saying that what we define as a lineage holder is dependent upon the quality of the students and the best students. Okay, so getting back, we says, often we are asked if it is possible to know which teacher will suit a particular student and if the teacher knows it. All depends on the quality and degree of realization of the teacher. The best of are those capable of understanding what is happening in the mind of the student, but they are very rare. Some people have such a strong karmic relationship with the teacher that just to hear his name is enough to fill them with devotion. Such was Milarepa's case when he heard the name of Marpa, and Gompopa's when he heard the name of Milarepa. If we feel devotion, faith, and strong sympathy for someone, perhaps we have a certain karmic link with him or her, and we could ask the teacher to become our lama. However, in a general way, according to Buddhist scriptures, the first thing to do is to verify whether the teacher is genuine by referring to the qualities mentioned earlier. Finding a perfect master is without doubt rare and difficult, but if we find a teacher endowed with most of these qualities, we can certainly ask him or her to become our guide. If he has but a few of these qualities, perhaps it is wiser to refrain. Anyway, it is important to remember that no matter how great the knowledge and qualities of the chosen teacher, in the end, it is the student who must learn and practice. One's own students and practice are the most important factors. So now we get to, and I'm not sure now, I'll probably bring it up two times, but I feel like I want to say it now, and I might say it again later, is this is referring to when his Chopje Kalo Rinpoche appeared, came to Thupten Choling recently, and we have on our website his image and this little piece of text, which I believe Lama Chodron wrote, but in any case, I'm just going to read from it again, where he says, we need a teacher or instructor to guide us along the path, and in order to fully realize the path, we need devotion. He repeatedly defined devotion as not guru worship, which he discouraged, but as a constant sense of inspiration, motivation, connection, presence, and mental clarity based on our relationship with our teacher. So that's why that spoke to me, where it said again in this paragraph we just read, the last two sentences, it says, anyway, it's important to remember that no matter how great the knowledge and qualities of the chosen teacher, in the end, it is the student who must learn and practice. So again, when he says the devotion in his mind is this art, how it manifests to us, our devotion to the teacher is as what type of consistency we have in our sense of inspiration to practice, motivation to practice, connection with practice, and the type of presence and mental clarity that that arises for us based on our practice. So the last...
Before we move on, Lama Jinpan, I just have one observation I would like to make, which is, in the paragraph that you just read, where it says, if we find a teacher endowed with most of these qualities, we can certainly ask him or her to become our guide. I think when we look at the list of qualities, some of them may be more optional to us than others. So it's, you know, it's not purely a question of they have most of them, but there may be one or two qualities that we consider absolutely, you know, essential. Mm. So as we're looking at the list of qualities, we can keep that in mind too.
Which is why, honestly, the list of qualities, especially when it talks about, you know, extensive scholastic, et cetera, you know, background, et cetera, this is why I picked up what spoke to me most of Mingyur Rinpoche when he said there are four qualities that accompany authentic teacher, which is authentic lineage, history of study and practice, compassionate and good-hearted, and being humble. Anyway, that I thank you very much for that. That's, I agree wholeheartedly. Thank you. And so now we're in the final part of the five of how to now work with the teachings in the right way. And it says, Gompopa compares the right attitude of a sincere student to that of a sick person anxious to get well as quickly as possible. The spiritual friend, the teacher, is the doctor, and the teaching is the treatment. Understanding and practicing the Dharma is like following a course of treatment and taking one's medication. In the Vajrayana, it is often said that disciples must have total, unlimited confidence in their teacher, or their master, sorry. Some people find this statement disturbing. It must be understood correctly. It is true that the purer vision of our guru that we have, the better student we become. It is said that if we see our master as a Buddha, we will become a Buddha. So it's not saying here, you know, what it's saying here is if we project onto this teacher that they are Buddha-like, then we will become Buddha-like. If we consider them to be someone very talented, a great scholar or a great saint, we will also become a great scholar or a great saint. Whereas if we see him as no different from ourselves, we will remain as we are. It is for this reason that great importance is given to choosing one's teacher. If our examination, our critical judgment is faulty, we are lost. Finding the right spiritual friend is the most important thing in a life. When we have found him, we have already made half the journey. If it is so important to choose one's master well, it is also important not to waste too much time before making a decision. And this actually came up with His Holiness Karmapa in his commentary on the verse 6 last time, but I'll just read it here. It says, long ago, a Chinese emperor invited Sakya Pandita, a great Tibetan Lama, to his court. When Sakya Pandita arrived, the emperor announced that he had to examine whether he was worthy of becoming his master. He examined him for 3 years and finally declared that he accepted him as a master. Sakya Pandita replied that he, in turn, had to decide whether he could accept the emperor as a disciple. He died before giving his answer. So, anyway, that's the point is, and as His Holiness Karmapa said, Wisdom practice. I'm just looking for here. He said, further, since read two paragraphs here. It says, once we've accepted someone as our spiritual friend, however, we search no more. We should already have done whatever tests were necessary to find out whether the qualities of this potential teacher were greater than his or her faults. And at that point, we should have made our decision. Having done so, we stop evaluating the teacher. At this point, there is no benefit in continuing to test because now we have to relate to that person as our guide. And he says, further, since every human being has a positive side and a negative side, both qualities and faults, we will certainly find some faults. There is no human being who is free of every fault. If we find some faults in our new spiritual friend, we might seek out another teacher and begin anew with another chapter. Again, we will go through the whole process of investigation and testing, and again, we will find faults. So the process will just keep repeating ourselves, meaning that, you know, well, if we continually focus on faults and give up and say, well, that's no good, and keep searching and searching, we can never settle, and we could spend our whole life trying to find the right spiritual friend and never receive any of the benefits the relationship has to offer. So now I'm back to Rinko Toku, just page 30, the last two paragraphs, where it says, you should accept someone as your guru only when you are completely sure that he or she is the right guru for you. If you choose the right person, your spiritual teacher will not ask you to do something reprehensible like killing or stealing. If you are given an instruction that you don't understand or that you feel is not correct, the scriptures say clearly that you can refuse and tell your master that you are unable to do what he is asking. It is not compulsory to blindly obey everything that your master tells you to do. You can then tell him that you are not prepared to do as he asks. If your master cannot accept it, he is indubitably not the master who suits you. In following the path of the bodhisattvas, we should go at our own pace according to our own level. Accomplished bodhisattvas should certainly be capable of giving all they have, even their lives, for the benefit of others. However, this does not mean that having taken the bodhisattva vows, we should at once be able to sacrifice our life for others. That's not the point. The scriptures say that if we don't mind giving away a bowl of curry, we should give it. When what we feel for our body is no different from what we feel for a bowl of curry, we can also give away our body if necessary. This is how we proceed progressively. And so that ends my presentation on this chapter. And I'm open now if anyone has any comments, questions. And Lama Chodron, I guess you'll be unmuting, and you can unmute yourself as well. Okay, John? John?
Okay, John, I'm going to unmute you. Oops.
Okay, so
John, okay, I think you're unmuted now. John, I'm having trouble, as often happens. Go ahead.
I said I was, but let me see.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, so can you give me or...
Yeah, it says you're muted, but yeah.
Okay, but can you explain perhaps how we are supposed to navigate the distance between a teacher and a student? And I don't know, it sounds like from the teachings that the student and teacher are like bunkmates almost, where it's not the case in today or then, I don't know. But it's like a lot of distance sometimes, where you don't get to see them for a year. And what advice would you, or what, how can you explain?
That's a very, very, very good question. I've struggled with that one myself because, my root lama was the previous Kala Rinpoche, who I was in his presence. Someone brought me up to the monastery, and it was like I heard him speak, and something, whatever merit was, you know, whatever virtue was awoken, and then I saw him the weekend that they were putting the second cycle of retreat into retreat. I started crying. I knew nothing about Buddhism, and I'm like, I have to do retreat. And I took refuge with him. I only saw him. I only met him in the last 2 years of his life. I never personally spoke with him. I was only involved in group interviews. So that's number one. I actually never had any personal interaction with him, personal one-on-one interaction. And when the last time we as a group were out in California, 1980, the winter of, I think, of 88, because I think he passed the spring of 89, he said, well, you know, my memory of it, and it's apparently it's something similar, but was that I promise you, if you follow Lama Norla Rinpoche, you'll become enlightened. And I took that to be my root lama saying to me, this is who you should work with. Okay. And so it's very interesting in my own experience. And this is the first time I'm probably saying this out loud. And I'm, you know, well, you're all Dharma brothers and sisters and everything, but, anyway, the point is, I always saw Lama Norla Rinpoche as my living connection with the previous Kala Rinpoche. And I had it was a difficult relationship with Lama Norla Rinpoche. I never had that soft and fuzzy. First of all, it wasn't just, now I lived at the monastery full time since 1990. So that's almost 30 years. I did 2 3-year retreats with him as my spiritual guide. But even though I had I was within his vicinity in that he lived at the monastery and was there at least half a year, we had a language barrier. I could never speak. I could read Tibetan. I learned to read it, but I have a bad ear. I could never speak Tibetan. I mean, I could learn sort of rudimentary stuff and conversational stuff, but all the high-end stuff I couldn't understand. I had to relate on a translator.
And I struggled with that my whole experience. And I said to him at different times, I feel bad because I can't understand. Like, if I'd ask him a question, like, you know, like it says, we're supposed to go to the Lama and ask about these deep issues, whatever. Most of the time he would just say, just don't think about it, watch your own mind. That's number one. Because most of it, again, is just a whole lot of conceptualities, your mind spinning around. And he would just come back to who's thinking and, you know, basic stuff like that. Or he'd start talking to me in pretty high-end Tibetan. And I would say to him, I feel so bad that, you know, I'm not able to speak Tibetan directly with you. And he would say to me, and I'm sorry, but I was never able to learn English fully. And so there was always, in my mind, that obstacle, the language barrier. And when I got to, many years ago, at least 10 years ago, when Lama Norla Rinpoche, one of his last trips to India, with where he was taking us as a group, I don't even know how many years ago it is, maybe 15 years ago, whatever, I had a private interview with Thaisa Rinpoche, and I actually spoke to him, and I said, you know, a very brief one, but I said, you know, that's been one of my biggest problems, is this notion that I have, that I have such a language barrier with Lama Norla Rinpoche. And he looked at me and he said, and this is not for me to be like bragging or anything, he said, this is not coming from that. What he said to me was very interesting. He said, I think you understand each other. Both of you understand each other really well. So it was very interesting to me, because when I look back now, what I got from Lama Norla Rinpoche, even though, you know, obviously I got great teachings through great translators, and we got great teachers, came to the monastery through him, whatever. But a lot of what I got from him was observing him. And I remember him even saying that once, was like, you know, and I know Lama Jidren, we talked about this in a previous class, but that many times I would just watch him when he would like meditate, and I would just watch him. And that became the transmission, so that when I meditate now, I bring an image to my mind. So to get back to your question, and I'm sorry if I've been too personal or whatever, but it's to say that the notion of distance is it's many different layers of it, and that you can be in the same room as a teacher and you don't even know he's there, you know, or her, she's there. You know how your mind just drifts off. Like, here we are in an empowerment, and we're all supposed to be one-pointedly whatever. And like, you realize, like, holy cow, I've just totally zoned out and I didn't hear anything they just said for the last 5 minutes. So that even when you're in close vicinity with somebody, you may be miles away. And that even if you've only seen a teacher then once or twice, if they impact you in such a way and you bring that to mind, then you're actually never separate from them. And that notion of being separate is truly just in your own mind. You know, like when my mom passed and I thought, oh my God, but I have her legacy is every time I think of something she said. So she used to say to me when I go, oh God, I'm so busy. And she'd go, no, but it's good busy, and it's better busy than being bored. You know, these little things that I have, and the same thing with Lama Norla Rinpoche, no longer with us. But anytime that something Dharma comes up to me, or I can think of him, then I'm not separate from him at all. He's always with me. You know, I have the teachings. So that's how I would speak to your question.
Okay, I'm just going to ask if anybody else has questions or comments. Like, if anybody else, I just want to get a sense. We've just got a couple of minutes. Okay, Mark and Deidre. If anybody else does, raise your hand so we know how much time we can spend.
Well, Jinsang, I think you have a very good understanding of things. That's my comment.
Well, and yet I still suffer emotionally. I still like forget, like, wait, it's all impermanent. Wait, you're like contracting and holding on, but, you know, intellectual, but putting it
in. It's like all the rest of us.
Okay. Deidre?
I think I'll unmute Deidre.
Yeah.
I also got a chance to see Kala Rinpoche while he was here in San Francisco, and connect with him very briefly. But it was like connecting directly with Lama Norla Rinpoche. So same experience in reverse. But it was also very much like connecting with His Holiness Karmapa. I could not tell the difference between any of those. They were seamless. And what it felt to me was the like a booster shot. You know, like you get your lama's instructions and you get his blessing to do the practice and you do your practice. But every once in a while, I have, because I've always been far away from the monastery and far away from pretty much everybody else, I've always felt good when there is a physicality with direct lineage teachers. And also this is very helpful, getting the teachings online from two very devoted and longtime students of Manorla Rinpoche and Kala Rinpoche and Taisi Tu Rinpoche, Mingyur Rinpoche. These all have such a strong connection for me. But again, the physical need is still there for me to go directly contact with one of the lineage holders.
Okay, thank you, Deidre. Anybody else have a comment or a question? Okay, Lama Jinsong, do you have anything else you want to say before we do our prayers then?
Yeah, this is another personal thing. You know, before Lama Rinpoche, when he was alive and he was building the whole thing about the Maitreya Center, and we were all like just overwhelmed, you know. Oh my God, how can we possibly do this? You know, and it was so enormous, and the responsibility of then holding the monastery with that. And who could have conceived that he would pass away before, you know, whatever. But the point is, it was as if when he passed away, like his little body wasn't there for me to focus on anymore, you know, like this. And all of a sudden, it's like, I got his intention, you know, I got what his whole vision was for the monastery. And it became like the entire monastery became like his manifestation. So it was just a very interesting, again, way of relating to the teacher, you know, and our, I mean, I have the same thing as Deidre in terms of being reinforced. But ultimately, like it says in this text, as Rinpoche Thoku is saying, that ultimately the ultimate lama that we take refuge in will be, or the ultimate Buddha is our own mind and the nature of our own mind. And that what we need to do, like, you know, Rinpoche used to yell at me and he'd go, I'm teaching you everything. Why are you not doing, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. But it was like, if we have to take that responsibility, and if we have the courage to actually apply ourselves in the ways that we've been shown, then again, that's the practice. And then we're never, ever, ever separate from the Lama, you know? Anyway, that's all I can say.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lama Jinsong.
Oh, well, hope it was helpful.
All right, I'm going to, just before we do the prayers, remind everybody that as of now, we are on holiday break, and we will reconvene in early January, the first Thursday after the new year. I'll get that to everybody. You have plenty of material to work with. You can review. Review is fabulous. You can read ahead. What we're going to be doing next is the next chapter, chapter 4, which is impermanence, which is a big topic. So if you want to read ahead to the impermanence chapter, read it in these resources, read it in other resources you have. You could use this time to come to a really good understanding through reviewing impermanence. You always see something new. And then we'll be ready to discuss it in January. All right, anybody got anything else before we do the prayers? Okay, so we won't see you next week. Hollywood Squares is like off until January. And now we will, with our prayer sheet, do the dedication of merit, taking a moment again to bring our minds to rest from all of this activity and thinking and contemplating back into a sense of being in our body, being grounded in our body, in our posture, in this present moment of awareness. Opening up our awareness, relaxing it. And now wishing for all sentient beings to attain enlightenment through this activity of ours, and we will chant the four formal verses. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of sorrow, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri, to train myself in their example. I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And back to a moment of resting and open awareness. And now I will unmute everybody. Everybody's unmuted. We'll see you next time, Steve. We were glad to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for the teachings. Yeah.